So welcome back to the podcast, Ian.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Now, firstly, I guess where we usually start these conversations, can you update us on how the streamers are doing from a financial perspective? And are there any insights into why Netflix in particular continues to do so well despite all the long-term predictions?
Well, I think you've got a couple of things which are happening there. Generally, if you look at the overall financial performance of the streamers, it's heading in a more positive direction. There is, and that really has been driven by a change in their strategies. If you go back 2, 3 years ago, certainly 3 years ago, it was very much a pro-growth strategy, really sort of trying to drive as much growth in the market, which meant expenditure. The pressure from Wall Street was then that the streamers had to cut their losses and move more into profitability. And that's really been the focus, simply because, for many of these company management teams, they were looking at the share prices and saying it's been weighed down by changing analyst expectations, investor expectations of the future of the streaming market. So if you look from a financial numbers standpoint, it is a more positive trend. There is the elephant in the room, of course, is that whether the performance of streaming for many of these companies actually offsets what they have lost from their traditional TV businesses. And the answer at the moment is almost certainly no. So we still have a very long way to go for many of these companies in terms of streaming, really been a long-term, certainly from a financial standpoint, credible alternative to the businesses they had before. When it comes to Netflix, certainly from a share price perspective, Netflix is very much a darling of the sort of Wall Street at the moment. If you look at the Q4 expectations on the subscriber addition side, really again there are expectations. My view on that, I'm slightly cynical with what happened in Q4. Bear in mind, obviously, the end of the quarter was December 31st. You had the NFL games, which are on sort of Christmas Day, so on Netflix, and there's a strong argument to say that given that this is the last quarter, that Netflix will actually release published subscriber numbers, but essentially there's a big incentive there to make that number as much as possible. And of course, if subscribers are watching games on Christmas Day, it's very unlikely they will cancel their subscription by December 31st. But sort of regardless of that, that's a small point. I think with Netflix itself, it continues to do sort of very well. The big question there again is whether the future forecast, the financial forecast, and its performance justify the valuation that you're seeing in terms of market capitalization. And as I usually say, this is not investment advice, but my view is probably not.
There's two or three things to unpack, perhaps, if we could. I mean, at various start of the year meetings over the last few years, there's often been predictions that insert name of global giant here will buy Netflix this year. That seems to have abated a bit, but is there always that feeling with their capitalization that at the back of the mind that perhaps they might get acquired at some point, and that might be keeping them buoyant.
No, I think the M&A angle is probably for Netflix, it's probably gone. I mean, one is it's just generally the, I mean, it's the size of the company probably is the key thing. There are very, very few potential buyers who could buy up Netflix. You're essentially looking at the big tech giants, the Amazons, the Apples, the Alphabets, the Metas, and so forth. Could really buy this company. And even then, even if they were to buy it, the financial outlay that they would have to make in order to do it would almost spook at Wall Street. So from that standpoint, I think it's not going to happen. Bear in mind all those tech companies as well, at the moment they're spending tens of billions of dollars on AI. And that really is the priority for them, sort of over the short to medium term, not necessarily making a big acquisition bet in the form of Netflix. The second thing, though, is the regulatory environment. And if you look at the states and what's happening there had been a feeling that the new Trump administration would reduce many of the levels of the regulatory investigations that the Biden administration had done. That's not the case. If you look at it, the new administration has said we will continue to follow the policies of the Biden era. And what that effectively means is the relatively tough line that you've seen against tech will continue. So the chances anyway of the tech giants being allowed to buy Netflix, I think would be relatively low.
Interesting. Is that Ed, what I guess the attraction to me of Netflix from it being a bear of little brain is that they just do the one thing. You know, they are a video streaming service. They're not trying to get you to do other things. They're not linked like Amazon to a massive, you know, retail and wider conglomerate. They're not trying to sell iPhones like Apple TV. They're not involved in stream, you know, linear like Disney or Paramount, etc. The original company that came along and just did one thing is still doing one thing. I guess the change, and you've alluded to a bit there, is the widening of their perceived remit from simple, you know, drama and comedy and scripted into reality, and in particular sport, which I assume is something you're watching with interest, the impact this is having on sports rights, and potentially, as we were discussing with Guy Bisson from Ampere recently, potentially the impact that's having on local broadcasters, who may have been hanging on to sport as like their life raft in turbulent times.
Well, you really have a difference here between the US markets and everywhere else. So, yeah, come back to your point before about Netflix is a very clean business in terms of what it does. Absolutely true. That could be a strength and it can be a weakness. It can be particularly, you can have a great amount of focus, but it does mean that if the market in which you are operating in starts to come under pressure, what are your alternatives? When it comes to Netflix's move into sport, I think my view is they're going to have to move into it more aggressively at some point. If you take the US market, this is a well-known stat, but over 70% of the top 100 programs, linear live programs in 2024 in the US, were NFL games. And that's in a year when you had the presidential election. So realistically, if Netflix, first of all, wants to attract more subscribers, but then second of all, also as well, wants to attract a substantial amount of advertising money, which is part of its strategy, then in the US market, it makes more sense to move more aggressively into live sports. The problem at the moment is that most of those contracts that are locked up, particularly around the NFL, are locked out for a considerable amount of time. So they're probably going to have to concentrate on things such as the MLB, sort of which we've seen the dispute with ESPN, sort of, and the baseball league over that, to really try and build things up. And it's going to be a long-term strategy as well. If you sort of take a more fundamental step back, though, with Netflix and sort of what this is all about, come back to that point before, it's a simple model. This is effectively a, like any traditional pay TV model, it is your number of subscribers times your average revenue per user, the amount of money that you can extract from that subscriber. Now, what's happened is, yes, they've done very well in terms of the left-hand side of the equation, growing their subscriber base. But there's going to be a natural limit to that, given the fact that you've got limitations in what you can do in China, Russia. And if you listen to the language of the streamers, which I think hasn't really been fully appreciated in terms of the consequences of this, talking about India being now increasingly lumped into those markets where, quite frankly, it's extremely hard to penetrate into. And so, as sort of they look to drive revenue growth, what you're seeing is that the shift is changing from the subscriber numbers over to the amount of revenues they can extract per subscriber. And that's going to be a trend that continues. There is a reason why Netflix has stopped releasing its quarterly subscriber numbers. Yet this is not usually a positive sign when it comes to momentum within a company with regard to this metric. So when you look at it in terms of what things they can do to drive up the amount of revenues they get per customer. Obviously, they could do price increases, and that's one thing as well. But you're effectively then looking at, as it were, secondary products. How much extra can you get from advertising? Yeah, what can you do in terms of as they try to do video games. What could they do in some of the potential areas? Now, their problem is so far is that if you look at some of their ancillary efforts that they try to do, particularly things like games, they haven't really worked. So, what they have to sort of go back to is the core business. How can they get more money from people in order to watch their core TV products? And the obvious answer to that is to buy more sports. So, longer term direction of travel, almost certainly Netflix will have to drive more sports. However, to go back to this point before about the difference between the US and the European markets, the economics only make sense in the US. They do not make sense in the European markets.
So it's a cliche that people have been using recently, but to what degree are the streamers effectively, by moving into sport and widening their coverage from their initial laser focus on specific, primarily scripted TV, are they just recreating the pay TV model?
Yes, but again, I think this is something that this is one of the sort of key talking points that gets missed in the debate over TV and what happens to TV, what happens to streamers, etc. It's not one model, one global model that works. There's effectively a US model, and there's the rest of the world. And in the US, that statement would, I think, is increasingly correct that what effectively the streamers are becoming are like the old pay TV model. So again, you've got Amazon, you've got YouTube, you've got NFL rights, you've got Apple, which is moving to Major League Soccer. They are increasingly looking like the old pay TV operators. For me, what's going to be interesting, let's say on a 3 to 5 year view, what happens with ESPN? If it's essentially taken over by one of the tech giants, and I still think there could be some regulatory issues with that, then effectively you've got much of the transition that has already been done. However, ex-US, I don't think that statement is correct. Because again, if you look at sort of what's happening in terms of streamers in most of the markets, yes, the traditional pay TV model is stagnating or in decline in most of those markets. However, there is not that sort of, as it were, that natural product that the streamers have that can make them to replace the pay TV operators. Because what the most pay TV operators depend on, they depend on live sports. And it goes back to this point before. The economics of buying expensive football rights in markets such as the UK, Germany, Italy, etc., the economics just don't work. This is why you've seen players such as Amazon. They bought rights, selective football rights in markets, and then they've actually exited. And the reason they've exited is because they just can't generate the revenues to justify the cost. So, from that regards, I think we have to be a bit more sort of, we can't just sort of put this cliche on the whole of the global streaming market. It's very much geographically weighted. I'd add one final point, sort of, and don't want to belabor this point because in itself it could be a separate, entirely separate podcast and topic. But I think what this point also demonstrates, and it's one of the big strategic fallacies of not so much Netflix, but I would argue most of the other global streamers, is that what they have done is they've looked at the global TV markets in the lens of the US. And that has been one of the big fundamental strategic errors that those companies have made, and it's contributed a lot to their problems.
It's fascinating. I was at an event last week where one of the panel members, I think it was from RTL, commented that we really need a European version of LinkedIn. And I think that wasn't so much in the context of the politics in the US, but just the comment that certainly in our area, measurement, whenever anyone posts something on the topic of measurement, someone from the US will leap in underneath with some comment that's incredibly specific to the US market, doesn't really apply anywhere else, but there it doesn't occur to them that non-Europeans are using LinkedIn. That there is this assumption sometimes, I think, on both sides, perhaps, not just in the US, but also there's a fascination in Europe with what's going on in the US and whether it'll roll out or not. But I think you're spot on. There's danger that it's assumed that what happens in measurement in the US, what happens in media in the US, necessarily works elsewhere, or vice versa, is quite damaging in a way.
Yeah, I mean, it really covers the, colors the whole debate. I mean, if you go back and look at the management's, the way that managements are formed years ago, or their experience years ago, I mean, you had to have a, I mean, if you worked for somebody like a Coca-Cola and et cetera, I mean, you did travel the world, as it were. The whole idea was that you got to learn about what was happening in markets outside the US. Now, there's a case for arguing that some of that expertise has been lost. And I think, particularly for the media industry, particularly again, it goes back, the streamers sort of even more so in terms of this. Their way of thinking, their way of looking at the world is very much through the US lens. And time and time again, if you look at what have been the fundamental errors that the streamers have made, it has been sort of the root cause of them has been effectively this view of everywhere can be like the US. And, for example, not really thinking about the politics of going into markets such as Russia, not thinking about the fact that, yes, superficially, Europe and the US may look similar in terms of demographics and income levels, but European consumers have been used to paying far less for their TV services than the US markets. Yet this has colored the whole debate around what's happening within TV. And again, it continues today. If you look at sort of the commentary around this YouTube TV, it's very much dominated from a US standpoint. Yet the nuances that you get to for markets outside the US really seem to be sort of brushed aside. And the view seems to be that very much, the rest of the world will automatically follow what's happened in the States. If I had to point a finger to that, I think, what would be interesting is to look at the management teams of many of these sort of US-based streamers, look at their backgrounds. If you look at it, effectively what you're looking at, people have either got a background in US TV, so that's going to be their natural sort of view of viewing the world, or to a smaller degree, they come from the movie industry. And that typically has been, for many of these companies, that's where their managements have come from. And of course, movies is a global business. They are used to selling US movies across the world, and it works well in most markets. But TV is not movies. Yeah, most markets, when you look at it, they prefer local content, even if their core language is English.
One of the accusations that's I think rightly been made to Hollywood recently is a massive over-reliance on certain franchises, Star Wars, the Marvel, DC universes, endless remakes of 1970s things like Alien and so on. I know recently you've been commenting more in the TV sphere that over-reliance on content for franchises could be damaging. Do you want to expand a bit on why you think that may be the case?
Yeah, sure, because what's happening is you're relying on tried and tested franchises that have an audience who have watched that programming before. Now, from a financial standpoint and from an investor standpoint, that's a plus. Because the way that investors look at it is to say, well, if you've got a dependable stream of revenues, we're much more willing to pay for that because we have more certainty over what's going to be guaranteed. And so there's been, as it were, I always say that you've got to look at sort of where the incentives are sort of for management. And often what will happen is it's sort of the next layer up. And if you look for the CEO, the CFO of a major entertainment company, what they're sort of concerned about, because these are the people who can fire them from their jobs, are what analysts and investors are thinking. And analysts and investors will prefer those companies to invest in tried and tested franchises because at the end of the day, they know they work, and there's a sort of a larger, not totally guaranteed, there's a large chance that those sort of products will do relatively well from a financial standpoint. The problem with that, however, is that essentially you're looking at short term over long term, because what that means is that you're not expanding the sort of potential sort of future pipeline, because you're relying on tried and tested ones that at some point may break down and fail. And if they do, you haven't tried other potential hits or other new formats, et cetera, that could provide the next level of growth. Or you haven't provided that unexpected hit that suddenly takes $500 million globally at the box office, but only costs $50 million to produce. So what's sort of what's happening here is that the entertainment companies are really taking a very risk-averse approach. They're saying, we don't want to take any gambles here with franchises that may not work. We'd much rather stick to franchises that, quite frankly, we think we have more visibility on, because we think that will please the financial markets. As I said, and the problem with that is that at some point it really doesn't happen. One thing I would say, it's a similar sort of thing if you look at it to what's happening in the video games industry at the moment. What you're starting to see is that the major video game developers are not really developing new franchises. All they're trying to do is sort of expand the existing ones that they've got and try and squeeze more out of them. And I think the fundamental dynamic here is pretty much the same as to what's driving that. It's not only investor pressure, but if you think from a consumer standpoint, a lot of consumers are feeling squeezed. And the cost of a video game is not exactly cheap. And the cost of going to the movies are not exactly cheap sort of these days either. And so consequently, again, consumers are probably less willing to actually bet on either a new video game or going to watch a new type of movie, so than they would have been in the past. And that also, as well, it is an issue to consider.
It's fascinating. And there's two, I think, related points that kind of amplify what you're saying there. One is that it's a theory of mine that, with the exception of really Stranger Things and Harry Potter, all these franchises date back to when baby boomers were teenagers. The baby boomers are now, at the most senior levels of the industry. That's Star Wars from the 70s, Marvel Comics from the 60s, even Doctor Who. Those shows that have that familiarity, whereas you wonder how much they are resonating with very younger TV viewers, and whether and moviegoers, and the increasing influence of things like Korean aesthetics and culture and K-pop and stuff like that, whether part of the reliance on these franchises is because they get greenlit because someone goes in and says, "Oh, why don't we revive the $6 Million Man?" And someone goes, "Yeah, I used to love that as a kid. Let's do it." It's that sort of the recognition at the studio level, not just the audience level as well. It's almost like there used to be a band called Pot Will Eat Itself. The idea that eventually you just end up eating your own content.
I think that's a very good point. I mean, there's a wider context here as well, is that people in the media industry, their viewing habits are entirely different from the general population. And I mean, I saw this in the financial markets as well with investors and analysts. The way that they perceive things is that they view it through their own lens. Companies know that as well. I mean, I won't name sort of the company involved, but there was a very well-known pay TV operator that what they would do for their analysts and investors who took Sky was put them on their VIP. I just mentioned that there. Was put it on their VIP package, because essentially what they realized was that if those analysts and investors got a good customer service when they rang up, that would make them feel more positive about the company in general, because it's natural. People take their own experiences and then extrapolate it across to sort of what they think is the experience for everyone. So you do have this tendency here where sort of and again, I think it's one of the big issues in the media industry which really doesn't get addressed, is that you've got a cohort of people who work in the industry who are, in effect, disconnected from the general population. And that's a big issue because if you're trying to think about what sort of services people want, what sort of programs people want, what's going to attract them, and so forth, you know what? You've got a, you're not coming at things from the same. From the same angle. It's very, very easy to get locked into a bubble, increasingly so, given the amount of time that's spent on social media.
I mean,
That's
the other
what I think the
thing,
industry as a whole has to do. It has to step out of that bubble.
I think I was reading a fascinating article. I think it was in Variety a few weeks ago, possibly even a few months ago, highlighting the dangers of that social media bubble in terms of fans. That the other drawback of reliance on big franchises is that they have huge fan bases. Who, if you don't get it right in their view, can kill something before it's even actually hit the screen. I mean, Star Wars is a classic example of that, where I think the series The Acolyte was virtually killed at birth by the negative reactions of fans to what they how it didn't meet their expectations, whereas a series like Andor that didn't do massively well in terms of viewing was renewed because the fans loved it. You know, that you're there was the conclusion a few people in the article were drawing was that actually, although you're taking a risk with coming up with new content that isn't franchise based, at least you're not facing the risk of people's preconceptions about what it should and shouldn't do and who should be in a relationship with whom, or that character would never do that.
Yeah, but again, it's the as the old phrase goes, I mean, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. I mean, again, it's the problem with this whole idea of and the need to step out of a bubble is the people sort of who are making the decisions think that effectively what has been said in social media represents the views of the world, and they don't. And again, on social media, it's the classic sort of the silent majority in terms of people who are effectively sort of are may have one view, but it's the most vocal who come out with things. Like if you want an example of that in let's call it a wider context, go back and look at last year when we had the US presidential elections. And think about sort of what happened with when Taylor Swift came out and endorsed Kamala Harris. The view then was that it would tip the election because there were so many sort of fans out there, and the Swifties would be a lot more energized, and they'd get out there and they'd vote for Kamala Harris, and particularly amongst the younger demographics, where actually the turnout levels were a lot lower. Actually, that didn't happen. Not only didn't it happen, but the younger demographics actually swung to Trump from where they had gone sort of 4 years previously. And this is sort of a I think, sort of reflective of a wider point here. If you think about the consensus narrative sort of about that move at the time, it was that was a game changer. But if you actually look at what happened in reality when it came to the cold light of day, it didn't make a difference. And so forth. And so, what I think sort of for many in the TV industry, and again, sort of it goes back very much to this point we talked about before in terms of these franchises, they've become very, very conservative and very risk averse. Pretty much a lot of levels of management. There is almost as though there's a feeling of walking on eggshells that if they don't go down the tried and tested route, then their jobs are at risk. As the saying always goes in business, nobody ever got fired for using McKinsey's. And if you want a similar sort of phrase in media, you could argue that nobody ever got fired for commissioning a Star Wars franchise. It's a similar sort of mentality and a similar sort of mindset.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see what Amazon do with James Bond now that the handcuffs are off, that the broccolis are actually out, and they can do what they want. Everyone's predicting, Miss Moneypenny series and video games and all sorts. So that'll be an interesting test, I think, of where these franchises are in terms of how much capability there is to financially exploit them before you become effectively you've milked, over milked the cow, or whatever expression you want to use. But I'm very conscious of time because you're right, we could be filling two or three podcasts with this. But there was just one more recent comment that you made, or blog that you made, I'd just like to follow up on before we finish. And that was very much about, you touched on it earlier, but the role of YouTube, particularly in Europe, and the increasing comments from observers like Evan Shapiro, who are very much recommending, certainly to UK broadcasters like Channel 4, that they should be going all in on YouTube, that having their content within their own walled gardens is limiting their appeal, particularly to young people, and that YouTube is the future, even for companies like the BBC. Do you see it that way?
No, I fundamentally disagree with that point of view. Yeah, and I think you've got several problems there with that sort of with that argument. The first thing is what people sort of miss a lot in that debate is there's a difference between, let's call them, gross revenues and net. And what do I mean by that? So people go, well, you want to put your content on YouTube. Because essentially, what that would mean is you can get an extra revenue stream. That would be the gross argument to say, here's your upside that comes through from YouTube. The net argument would be say there's a cost that is associated with that. What is that cost? Well, first of all, essentially people are not coming to your platform, and what you're having to do is any ad revenues that are sort of generated, instead of getting those, taking 100% of those, have to share it with YouTube, who may be taking 40%. So first of all, you've got that element to it. A second thing, though, which I think is actually more insidious, more dangerous, if you also look at the narrative that is being pushed at the moment, it is that, it paraphrase it, that YouTube should get more share of advertising because it's getting more share of viewing. What gets fundamentally missed in that argument is what makes up that viewing. Now, nobody is making the sort of really getting nuanced and saying, well, actually, a lot of YouTube viewing is either music videos or it's actually content from the TV broadcasters. But, the point being is that what people like are simple narratives. And so the idea that if YouTube has 30% of viewing, it should get 30% of advertising money. That is a narrative that is gaining a lot of attention, even though a lot of that 30% of viewing is effectively content from premium operators, as I said, such as the music companies, but also the broadcasters themselves. And so what the broadcasters risk doing is, if you want the analogy, it's providing the bullets to YouTube to fire the gun that will eventually kill them. Because if you look at the motivating factor behind YouTube and why we've seen such an uptick in this narrative at the moment that YouTube is TV, it's really tied into the financials. TV advertising markets globally, around $180 billion. YouTube advertising sort of revenues globally, $36 billion. If you look at the 4-year performance of YouTube globally in terms of growth, 14.7%, which is very good. But actually, not that much more than search for Google Alphabet, which grew 13.2. So, first of all, you've got this accelerating pressure within Google on YouTube management to drive their advertising revenue growth. And the other issue you've got here was that the growth in YouTube subscription revenues, which had been a key fundamental driver for them, is now slowing down considerably, or at least did in Q4. So they have to rely more on the advertising sort of side of things. And so what you've got here is that effectively, if YouTube is going to get fast growth, where does it need to take money from? It needs to take money from TV. And so for the TV broadcasters, what they're doing here is this is not really a win-win partnership. It might be in the short term, and it might be to the people who are incentivized within broadcasters to deal with partnerships with YouTube and to try and boost their revenues there. But for the broadcasters as a whole, what they're doing with many of these deals is potentially sort of fueling the rival who will take their money. Now, in my mind, better strategy is someone like what a TF1, TF1 has done in France. What it has said with its product is to say TF1 Plus is to say we want that to be the destination sort of for people, and we want that to replace YouTube as where people go. And this is why we put our content on there, because we wanted to be the destination site. And this again, I think really there's a big underlying fundamental question here that doesn't get asked. But do people watch platforms or do they watch content? If you believe that fundamentally people watch platforms, then you can see why the argument has come that people are saying you must put your content on YouTube. But I would argue that what people watch is content, and that's what they're drawn by. And if that's the case, there's a strong case for the broadcasters to be keeping that to themselves.
There's also the argument, I think, and I do agree with you, that the people it, they it's fine if people know what content they want and are heading to YouTube to find it, but the other thing that broadcasters would be surrendering by putting significant amounts of content on YouTube, they would be surrendering to the YouTube algorithm. So, when you are on iPlayer or ITVX, they are in control of their own recommendation algorithm. They can, make sure that what they want you to see is prominent. You are, I strongly suspect that when you're putting your content on YouTube, you are at the behest of that algorithm. And if, for example, BBC News was significantly on YouTube, and Donald Trump phones up his friends at Google and say, "Can you turn down BBC News, please? I don't like what they're saying at the moment." There's nothing the BBC could do about that.
Well, I mean, I think I may have mentioned this sort of in the past, either at the conferences or on this podcast. But, my background is a historian and particularly a war historian. And, what sort of history and wars in particular tell you is never become reliant on your enemy for your survival. And, if you want a more modern day equivalent of that, look at the reliance that Western Europe had on Russia in terms of energy sources and the problems that that became when essentially things turned around. It wasn't a problem until it was. And I think, again, that it is a very good point that, for the broadcasters, what they risk is that effectively, as you say, handing over control to YouTube and increasingly losing the sort of control of the narrative. Because this is not just about the algorithm. Over time, no doubt, it will become about the content. And at some point, you can't extract yourself. And once you can't extract yourself, then effectively you're beholden to that platform. And yeah, this is not, by the way, this is not a specific sort of a jab specifically at YouTube. I mean, they're doing what exactly they should do from a business standpoint, from a shareholder standpoint. But at the end of the day, YouTube's key priority will be YouTube. And when we look at advertising revenues as a whole, there is a limited pot of money out there. And I go back to what I said before. YouTube's advertising revenues globally are $36 billion. TV's are 180 billion. If you want to actually if you are YouTube management and saying, where do we get the next big chunk of money for advertising from? It's going to have to be TV. Newspapers, that's gone. Out of home is a niche and has its own benefits that can't be replicated. Audio is a niche. The big pot of money out there is TV money. That is where they have to get their growth from in the future in order to actually drive what they're doing for Alphabet as a whole and for their shareholders. And again, that should tell you when you look at the incentives, that should tell you what's likely to be in that outcome.
It's also, one suspects, why they, not just YouTube, but YouTube, Facebook, TikTok are such keen supporters of initiatives like Origin in the UK and Aquila in the US, looking to get the cross-media measurement in place so that they can have the statistics to be able to drive that push for TV revenue. So it's interesting how often things do often overlap quite a lot with the measurement issues that drive these discussions as well. But
No, well, I was just going to say on that point. I mean, as I say, I mean, given my background and interests, I tend to be quite cynical about sort of the motivations of people. I mean, one of the things that I'm not a in the depths of the measurement argument or the industry as many people are, but sort of looking from the outside and stepping back, the whole thing is, it reminds me a bit of sort of Stalin's comment that it's not the votes that count, but who counts the votes. The thing is here with the measurement industry and the sort of look for a common measurement standards. And you're right, sort of as to why there seems to be so much tech pressure, or tech support for this. It's simply because these companies know that they're going to be in pole position to set the standards for how measurement will be, of how the new measurement standards will work. And once again, in any industry, this is not just media, it's across the whole board in any industry. And time again, if you set the standards, the boring stuff, the sort of technical details that nobody really cares about from the outside, but if you set those standards, you pretty much end up controlling the agenda. And again, this comes back to a question of incentives. Cui bono, to whose advantage does this play out? That tells you a lot of motivations, who is supporting what, and what is driving the arguments that they're using.
well, that's an excellent point, I think, to leave on that question, because that's very much what ASI is going to be focusing at, focusing on over the next months and years, which is trying to guide that conversation and be a platform ourselves for open debate about where measurement's heading and what impact that does have back on the very huge financial decisions taken around broadcast streaming and the whole media ecosystem, which you've been very, very eloquent on today. It's one of our longer podcasts, but I'm sure that listeners won't mind because we've covered some fascinating areas, I think. So thanks for that. And we hopefully will catch up with you a bit later in the year, and hopefully we'll see you at our Copenhagen event in November. If you can get that in your schedule, that would be brilliant.
Well, thank you very much, Richard. It's been great to sort of join you today. And yeah, if anyone's got any questions, just please reach out.
Brilliant. Thanks for joining us.
No problem at all.